Hi all, we are back with the Danvers Armory heist of 1976. Nina and I decided to cover this when we were scouring through an FBI summary of Dad's activities that was provided to the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Labor Racketeering in August of 2002. That is an absolute mouthful. The 2002 investigation was completely unrelated to today's topic, so we will save that for the end of the Double Deal series itself, whenever that may be.
We will never get to the end of this range.
We need to get to the end. We have other podcasts we want to do. We have to finish the book.
Okay, minor details. But some not minor details were in that document. In the FBI's outline, there were two entries regarding Ritchie trying to give the feds information about the 1976 armory heist dated August 17th and August 20th, just days after the heist took place. Information that, according to the FBI, they just weren't interested in. The feds' notes inferred that Ritchie just wanted money in exchange for the information, and the feds weren't willing to cough up a nickel.
We never bothered to look at the next page of the summary. The minute we saw the armory info, we started researching. I was putting all of that to the side to start prepping for the next episode when I noticed on the following page, there's an entry dated September 22nd that Dad called the feds to complain that he hadn't been paid for the information that he had provided about the armory heist.
So they did take the information from him, but they didn't record it in a 302?
It was either conveniently left out or heavily redacted. I don't know. Remember, the feds wouldn't release any of the 302s to me from September of 1969 until the early 1990s. And even then, it's missing, I'd say, more than 75%. We have 302s from the JFK docs that were released up until 2017 that aren't noted in that summary. Forget about what they actually gave me for 302s. That's why I asked you to submit a separate FOIA under his informant number specifically. In my mind, this time around, the information was missing because the feds were covering for Whitey or Stevie.
I totally agree with that, and I'm betting that Zip Connolly told whoever the two agents were that Ritchie couldn't know anything to protect his two favorites, or he told them that Whitey was giving him information of a much greater value and he needed to stay in play.
Even if we had an entirely redacted clues with the dates, we'd have a better idea of what actually happened.
Well, that's for sure. But long story short, that's how we ended up here. I also found it very interesting that the heist was on August 14th, the same day the Plymouth Mail robbery took place, the same day ProLearner and company were arrested for the Maffeo Millay hit, and the one-year anniversary of the Bonded Vault heist.
And I'm sure we're probably missing something else, too.
Well, I'm sure, but for now, let's get to the question of the week.
Shoot.
Well, first, I have to say to David, sorry for not picking one of his questions this time.
I feel like we either need to invite David onto the podcast or set up a private Zoom meeting with him.
It's true, and he's done so much research, it would be super interesting. So, David, message me if you're interested. Now, for the question from one of our other amazing listeners regarding RICO charges and cases. To be clear about last week's episode, the massage parlor case was the first round of RICO indictments to go on trial in Massachusetts, not the U.S.
The first case was the so-called cowboy mafia, I think, that was based in the South in 78 or 77. I'm not sure.
I think so, but let's not get distracted. Let's get to our question.
All right. I know we're supposed to stay under 20 minutes today.
Exactly. So our listener wanted to know about the charges brought against Howie Winter and company in the racetracks track fixing case, also try saying that, and whether those also fell under RICO. So the answer is yes, but the indictments didn't come down until January of 79, and Howie Winter wasn't convicted until August 21st of 79. So the massage parlor case won the RICO race.
And that sort of rhymed.
Hey, now I'm a poet.
Oh, yeah.
But seriously, we will go into painful detail about the charges, Tony Chula's role as an informant, Zip Connolly covering for Whitey and Stevie yet again, and all that interesting stuff when we finally get to Howie in what should be mid-August.
We're making progress. Okay, before we get into the Danvers heist, do you want to give a little history about other armories in the area that had been hit over the years?
Yes, because you know I think Jack Kelly was responsible for planning it, if not the actual execution of a few of those armory heists. And according to Ritchie's tales, I am right.
And I agree with you. There is still one robbery of an armory in the 60s that I can't find. Again, I'm assuming the dead story wasn't fabricated.
Well, we'll keep looking and put it in the book. But for now, let's go back to the 40s. So from February to April of 45, and I just find the timing interesting since the war was winding down at that point.
So from the beginning of the U.S. involvement in the war up until the beginning of 45, they had armed security at all of the armories around the clock. In January of 45, the round-the-clock security was pulled. So it does make sense that they started robbing again in February of 45.
So interesting. Okay. So three of the 60 armories that were in Massachusetts at that time had been robbed of machine guns, shotguns, rifles, revolvers, and copious amounts of ammo. In that same time period, an armory just over the border in Dover, New Hampshire, was hit in a similar fashion. And we need to bring up the later case against the mayor of Dover, but not now. Maybe when we start doing our shorts this week. Maybe that can be one of the on the agenda.
Okay.
The authorities said that the thefts were well planned and carried out by professionals who, quote, had serious business, unquote, in mind. And who does that sound like?
Jack Kelly. Then on August 23rd, 1949, 26 Army-issue 45 caliber automatics and 7.30 caliber carbines were stolen from the West Newton Armory.
First, they picked up Thomas Correo and Ronald H. Boone for the heist itself. Then Thomas's cousin, Frank Chulo, who lived at 94 Prince Street, just across the street from the Angiulos, was arrested on possession charges after the cops discovered 21 of the pistols and 4 of the carbines in his car and apartment. All three men were convicted. Thomas's brother George and 3 others were also involved, but only Boone and Correa received sentences. The other 5 received 2 years probation. I just want to mention here that Thomas Correo had a lengthy record dating back to the 1920s and did time in San Quentin in the 30s. But didn't your great-grandfather also do time in San Quentin?
You're just jealous because you have a pristine and squeaky clean family tree.
Well, I still got some skeletons in the closet, but you always get those bizarre DNA matches.
Update your bio on the website in case folks want to hire you to help with their family tree searches.
Okay, this week, I promise. Anyhow, since you can't find the 1960s theft, let's move on to the Westerly National Guard Armory heist of November 1971, when Robert M. Eust and David Gillette, both of Providence, were charged with stealing rifles almost a year after the robbery took place. And this case indirectly ties back to last week's episode of the making ceremony.
Yes. So Nicholas Zinni and William Marapizzi, Bobo's cousin, were also wrapped up with the weapons along with Daniel LaPola. LaPola was under investigation by the IRS in an unrelated tax case. While listening to the wiretap, the IRS realized that they were involved with the guns and passed the info to the feds. LaPola flipped and was blown up in his Sterling, Connecticut home after his fellow thieves decided to take him out.
So William Marapizzi was convicted in 1974, along with Zinni, for the 1972 murder of LaPola and sentenced to life in prison, even though he was already serving 3 life sentences for other cases. Eust and Gillette were also sentenced to life for LaPola's slaying. The charges for the armory heist had to be dismissed after the murder of LaPola for lack of evidence.
And I told you last week when we were researching the making ceremony episode that William was into everything. I think he was more of a menace than Bobo was.
My goodness. So during the trial, Zinni's defense attorney said that Marapizzi was treacherous, but they were all treacherous.
That's what I just said. All right, now we're ready to move on to the Danvers case, please.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, on August 14th, 1976, the Danvers Armory was robbed of 7 M60 machine guns, 96 M16 semi-automatic rifles, 2 M203 rocket launchers, 10 flak jackets, 3 pairs of binoculars, a red-eye missile launcher, and a 45 caliber pistol, according to Arthur Montori, special agent in charge of the Boston office of the ATF. All of the firearms were without firing pins. State Police Lieutenant Colonel John R. O'Donovan made sure to emphasize that there was no danger to the public and that the firing pins were stored separately at the Danvers Police Station.
By that time, it had become common practice to store the firing pins in separate locations, often the local police department, like in the Danvers case. And after decades of thefts, it's not a surprise. But although the press was quick to deem the weapons as useless, that was the furthest thing from the truth. The thieves had entered the grounds of the armory via four holes that had been cut in the chain link fence. The lock was picked and the burglar alarm disconnected. Once inside, they approached the gun vault, where they used pickaxes to tear apart the concrete and steel reinforced wall and cleaned the place out. The items were believed to have been transported in a wheelbarrow, which was found abandoned near the fence on a path leading to the nearby Ramada Inn, and all piled into an unmarked white van.
I am trying to imagine an M60 in a wheelbarrow, but...
Not that big, but still, I'm trying to imagine like the rocket launcher type situation in the wheelbarrow. That's the thing.
Anyway, the theft wasn't discovered until Monday, August 16th, and an armory employee reported it to the authorities. They immediately began interviewing the hotel guests at the Ramada, hoping someone saw something. And since all roads lead to Maine, the first round of suspects were two guys there named Richard Pizzariello and Edward Guion. They were first linked to other robberies and bombings. Normally, I would say Richie, who stuck the feds on them, but those two were hippie radicals and probably on multiple lists of various law enforcement agencies.
And for all of Richie's fault, he was not teamed up with any hippies. And you know that Pizzariello, or whatever the heck his name was pinched in 97 during a protest on the campus at MIT?
Paid agitators. He had just gotten out of a two-decade stint in prison for blowing up a power station in Maine in 1977. And we are not going down that filthy road today or ever.
All I'm going to say is some things never change. Different decade, different so-called cause, same BS.
All right, Yuri Bezmenov Jr. over
it's there. True.
Okay. Speaking of things that never change, the New York Times ran a piece about the armory heist that read, "Faulty firearms stolen from National Guard armory."
Tell that to the family of those that were killed by those weapons.
Well, the New York Times has always never been so great at telling the truth.
Like I say, nothing ever changes.
Well, the so-called useless weapons were shipped back to Ireland in small shipments, of which one was seized by the authorities after they became suspicious of a crate in the mail marked, quote, "business machinery," unquote.
Well, that was their line of business. Another shipment was seized in December of 1977 when a ship bound for Dublin was intercepted after a tip from Belgian authorities. In addition to M60s, anti-tank guns, landmines, and Russian-made hand grenades were also seized. Who knows where those goodies came from? Just under a year and a half later, on Sunday, January 29th, 1978, in Derry, Northern Ireland, for a ceremony marking the anniversary of the Bloody Sunday massacre, one of the M60s from the Danvers heist was on display at a vehicle checkpoint along the commemoration march route. Four IRA men manned the spot and told reporters that the weapon could fire 300 rounds in a minute and claimed it had been used in two attacks against security forces in the recent months. As the roughly 5,000 attendees passed by, they cheered at the sight of it, and the headline in the Irish Independent read, "Super Gun on Show at March in Derry."
How Soviet.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few weeks later, on March 1st, one of those M60s was used in an ambush of a British patrol, which killed a 20-year-old soldier named Paul Shepherd. The weapon fired 41 shots in less than 3 seconds, according to police. It was the second killing in less than 24 hours. On April 3rd, the RUC confiscated one of the Danvers M60s from an IRA member while searching a house on Canvas Ave in Belfast. They also recovered a full belt of ammo, an incendiary bomb, and four pistols. And April was a busy month. On the 24th, the Garda recovered another one of the M60s along with 200 rounds of ammo after a road chase along the Bucarana-Derry Road. Then in August, two more of the M60s from Danvers were recovered from the IRA. On December 21st, three British soldiers were gunned down by the IRA using one of the M60s that was mounted to a makeshift armored vehicle. The attack took place in Cross Maglan just a few months before the Republican News printed a photo of a masked and hooded IRA man operating an M60.
A little over 2 months later, on March 1st, gunmen near the Cross Maglan on the Armagh border opened fire on a British Army helicopter. Three British soldiers were shot, but no fatalities.
Then 5 months later, and a little over 3 years after the weapons were stolen from the Danvers Armory, a roadside bomb ambush killed 18 British soldiers on August 27, 1979. It was the single deadliest incident of the conflict. It was also the same day that Lord Mountbatten was assassinated on his yacht by the IRA.
I'm glad that you have me slightly beaten in the cousin match on Dickie Mountbatten.
Yeah, I did not need to win that one.
Sure you did. While all of that was going on, an investigative reporter from the Boston Globe named Andrew Blake was interviewing Peter McMullen about his time as a member of the IRA and his activities in the U.S. and Northern Ireland. According to that five-part Boston Globe investigative report that began running on September 2nd of that year, an IRA representative met with the Danvers Armory thieves in Chicago and purchased part of the weapons, but he claimed that he did not know who the thieves were.
Which I don't buy, considering he claimed his initial job in the U.S. was to screen people selling weapons to ensure they weren't agents or informers working for the authorities.
In my mind, he did reveal who the buyers were, but the feds told him to keep quiet because they had to protect the Golden Boys. And you've seen the Valhalla docs that the FBI released on the Vault website. It was somebody had like a Sharpie party over there. You can't even read anything.
A total waste of time trying to glean any information from there. As for McMullen, he had entered the U.S. on a false passport in 1972. Prior to his arrival in the States, he bombed British Army barracks and shot British soldiers, and he participated in 9 bank and hotel robberies in both Ireland and Northern Ireland that netted $500,000. Besides screening potential sellers, he was organizing the purchases and the shipments back to Ireland.
During one of his trips back to Northern Ireland, he landed in jail. But upon his release, he slipped back into the States and even managed to obtain a U.S. passport under the name Terry Enright. According to McMullen, when the IRA ordered him to kidnap the New York businessman, he turned himself into the feds and spilled the beans. The IRA sentenced him to death in absentia and ordered him to return, but obviously he wasn't going to do that.
Well, the following month, in October of 1979, the trial of Shepard's suspected killers, Henry...
McCavanaugh.
I had it the first second there. Okay. And Francis McGuire commenced. And I have to assume that thanks to McMullen's cooperation with the government, the raid on the docks at the North Quay led to the seizure of M60s, Armalite rifles, and semi-automatic handguns. The weapons were recovered from shipping containers on a ship that had traveled from the States. The Garda wouldn't reveal how they received the tip-off or even the name of the ship.
Not to be dissuaded, the IRA set up a display in the village of Carrickmore to flex and show off 2 M60s, several RPG-7 rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and an abundance of Armalite rifles.
Well, I had to look. The population was below 500 people there.
Well, it was a captive audience.
I guess. But Cross Maglan was the real hot spot. A few weeks later, the IRA boys used an M60 to fire at a low-flying British Army recon plane that was surveilling the area after an 18-year-old soldier was killed by a landmine.
Really, it was nonstop madness in those days.
Yeah, the so-called peace wall in Belfast still gets cordoned off every night.
I know. Okay. In April of 1980, the story made its way back to Massachusetts when firefighters arrived at a vacant home in Walpole to find burning chairs and 2 metal trash barrels filled with 46 M16s, all still missing the firing pins, by the way.
Yeah, you have to figure someone, i.e. Zip Connolly, gave them the heads up that McMullen gave up the location.
Someone sent him into a panic, for sure. And the rifles weren't the only items recovered from the home. The authorities also found coins, silver, Hummels, and a closet full of piggy banks. Dozens of them. I had a nice piggy bank collection.
Yeah, didn't your aunt collect Hummels, too?
Yeah, she had them all over the house, but my Uncle Brendan threw them all out when she died. Some of those things are close to like a grand apiece now, and she had at least 50 of them.
What a nut.
What an asshole. I'm not supposed to swear anymore, sorry. Anyhow, the home belonged to Charles A. Gallant Jr., according to a story that ran in the Phoenix in April of 1986. While the authorities were in the house, a black Cadillac with 2 leaders of an quote-unquote Irish gang from Charlestown drove by. The next day, the Charlestown guys flew to Bermuda with the feds trailing not far behind. The would-be gang all checked into the same hotel, as did a well-known European arms dealer.
On April 14th, Dennis McLaughlin was arrested as he got off the plane at Logan from a trip to Bermuda. Some of you might recall that Dennis was the brother-in-law of Frankie Salemi. The authorities said they found a photo of him and Gallant in Gallant's home, and that was the link. but the charge against him was not related to that at all. The only thing they could come up with for a warrant was that he had four rifles and a handgun at his house in Seabrook, New Hampshire, and he was a convicted felon. But get this, he was also employed at the nuclear plant there as a heavy equipment operator.
It's New England. It's normal cronyism at its finest. What's wrong with you? Come on. Okay, the feds could never confirm whether a meeting actually took place in Bermuda. The charges were dropped against Dennis. The authorities said that it was like the case they tried to put together against the mayor from New Hampshire, who we mentioned earlier, who they believed was supplying the IRA with weapons, but it was just another dead end for them.
Yeah, okay, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, that's until the Valhalla case came along in September of 1984, which netted a 7-ton haul of armaments. Among those weapons were ones reported stolen mostly from homes in the Boston area in the 70s. The newer weapons had all been stripped of their serial numbers. 5 men were indicted in April of 1986. They included Joseph P. Murray of Charlestown, who might have been busy exporting weapons to Ireland, but was just as busy importing marijuana to the Boston area.
And he did so in style. According to an informant, Murray brandished a MAC-10 50 caliber machine gun with a silencer as he used to watch his dope being unloaded.
Peter Nee, Robert Anderson, and John McIntyre were also indicted, but all of that has to wait for the Valhalla episode.
Indeed. As for the Danvers heist, no one was ever charged, and it still remains an unsolved case. At least 10 soldiers were killed and 19 injured. I think our theory that it was a sanctioned Whitey and Stevie operation is highly likely. We'd love to hear from you guys if you know any stories about this robbery or if you have your own theories.
For sure. And next week, we will be back with the gambling cases against Larry Bioni and A.B. Sarkis.
And others. Thank you guys for listening. Bye.
Bye.